Missing this?
When that didn't materialise, I think both Paulie and myself probably looked at each other and kind of thought, what next?
Then get this, the all-new OTB Sports app. Off the Ball, Ireland's premier sports channel, now has a new home, featuring the biggest names in Irish and world sports. Podcasts, interviews, news, commentary, analysis, plus almost 20 years of sporting archives. All free and ready when you are, at home or on the go. The new OTB Sports app. Download it now from the App Store and Google Play.
The OTB Podcast Network with Virgin Media. Catch all of the UEFA Champions League and Europa League games live on Virgin Media TV.
So delighted to welcome this evening our guest on the Rugby Chat, Dan McFarland, Ulster coach. Dan, you're very welcome. How are you doing?
Good, thanks, Jay. Thanks very much for having me.
Listen, let's be honest with the listeners. We have done this already. We were a few minutes into our first conversation and then the joys of Wi-Fi kicked in. I'm not sure if it was you or me. It's a very COVID-19 problem.
Yeah, I'm actually a little bit surprised. I thought we'd all be used to it now with Zoom calls and Skype calls, but there we go. We'll manage.
So listen, to sum up where we were briefly, I had just, summed up your 2 years in charge at Ulster, and there was that quarterfinal against Leinster last year in Europe. Really brilliant performance by Ulster was the general consensus, and a Pro 14 semi-final defeat, which I know you were disappointed by. And this season, your second season, to lose a weight in European quarterfinal, and your second in Conference A. So you have games against Connacht and Leinster from the 23rd of August. 2 points there means you're in the semi-finals. And I'd asked you if you'd have taken that at the start of your tenure, and the old winner's mentality came out in you. You probably wouldn't have quite taken it. You're always looking for more.
Well, I think the question's got to be answered in the context of us having hindsight, and we can look back and say, look, we might have done something a little bit differently. Every time you don't get exactly what you want, and what you want every year is to win trophies, you look back and say, well maybe if I tried it a different way. And in that context, you're always saying, well, no, I'd actually quite like another go at it. But having said that, you know, as I say, there were a couple of big games there that ended our seasons in competitions. One was the Leinster quarterfinal, where we really felt that we played pretty well and were beaten by a better team. And that's not to say we couldn't have won that game, but you know, we were beaten by a better team. And then against Glasgow, we were certainly beaten by a better team that day, and we didn't play very well. So that was disappointing. But none of that's to put aside all the good work that was done to get to those stages. And there was a lot of fantastic work done by the playing staff and by the support team here who are excellent.
Name one thing you would have done differently.
One thing I would have done differently. Well, I'll tell you, I think that in the approach to the semi-final against Glasgow, I think there was possibly a sense of patting ourselves on the back a little bit too much after we'd beaten Connacht at home, and we'd had a home quarter final, and we played pretty well in that game, and you know, perhaps there wasn't enough edge going into that Glasgow away game. And you know, I'm only talking very, very small margins in what you're doing here. And when you arrive on a Glasgow pitch and they do have that edge, played really well all season. They got absolutely thumped in their own semi-final the previous year. They're playing for a home final against Leinster. It was always going to be a massive ask for us. And, you know, whether we were going to win or lose, we didn't need to get knocked over by the first wave that came along, and we did. And that was pretty disappointing. So potentially spending a little bit more time preparing for that first wave spending more time on that first wave, I think, was probably the key thing.
All that said, the general consensus is you're doing a really fine job, and even the Leinster performance in particular at the Aviva last year caught the eye, and that form has continued in many ways through to this season. Knockout rugby again in Europe to come, and hopefully a semi-final. Did you feel from early on you were on the right track with this group? Did it take some time? Because I'm sure you were finding your own feet. When did you start to think this is all moving in the right direction? And what criteria do you judge that by?
Yeah, that's a really good question. And somebody asked me that the other day as well. I think that coming in, I spent a lot of time trying to work out the context and understand the context of where the club was at that stage. And, you know, there was a lot of doom and gloom around the club and perception. I personally didn't see that. That's why it was such an exciting organisation to join and be a part of a journey. Potentially weren't playing as well as they could have done, but they're in a really difficult spot at that stage, and people were having to deal with a lot of things off the field. So it was a question of focusing the mind and finding out from the people within the organisation and also from my own perspective of looking at it, what was the most important question? You know, what was the first thing that we were going to address? And we worked that out as a group. I helped focus the mind on that and get people to believe in that key point and then push that. And I think it was probably after the first two or three games that we played in that first year and we won two of those games in the last minute I really felt that, like, man, we've got a bunch of guys both on and off the field here that you know, it really matters. You know, it really matters to them, and that's a foundation. Like it doesn't win championships for you, but you can't win championships without it. And that was a pretty critical moment. Yeah.
Okay. And what about finding your own feet and feeling in yourself? Geez, I may actually kind of have the hang of this head coach business.
I'm still waiting, Joe. I'm genuinely still waiting, and you know, that may be it might sound a little bit trite, but that's it. You just don't, like, the first year, it doesn't matter how much you prepare. And I was a pretty experienced coach when I arrived, but as an assistant, and you know, I'd worked with a number of head coaches and obviously played under a number of head coaches, and you know, I had a wealth of experience in terms of seeing people at work and in action, and in the last years as an assistant coach, I spent a lot of time learning and squeezing information out of those guys, but really, when it comes down to the position of the buck stops here now, it's a totally different situation. You do stand in a position where you're having to make the key decisions around that, and not just giving advice and thinking about it. And I think that takes a lot of getting used to, making it a job where people around you feel as if they can supply advice, but it's not just can, have to supply advice. That's pretty critical, and I've found that much easier over the last 6 months, and then you throw in the COVID situation that comes in there. Like, there's no settling. The job I've done over the last 6 months has been totally 5 months has been totally different to what a normal rugby head coach would have done. It doesn't matter which head coach it was; they've all been doing a different job. So that's been a learning experience in leadership and adaptability that's been fascinating.
Mm. I guess you're just across so much, and you have to be aware of every small decision, the minutiae of the running of a 43-man squad, I think it is. Like, I wanted to ask you, for instance, a couple of months ago, Jacob Stockdale came out and did a whole host of interviews. Really fascinating, gave a brilliant insight, spoke very well. But he was talking about how throughout much of last season, he was reading social media nonstop. For instance, so he talked about a game at Thomond Park where he said the first thing he did was go into the dressing room before he texted his girlfriend or before he got onto his family or checked in with anybody. He went onto Twitter to see what people were saying about him. Now, he knew himself this was not a healthy thing to do and it was affecting his confidence, but this is what he was doing anyway. Would you have been aware, for instance, that something like that is going on?
Yes, look, you know, you have conversations with players the whole time, and you know, at the time it might not be the particulars of that. You know, Jacob didn't come into me the following morning and tell me that he'd been looking at Twitter and it had upset him. But you know, you'd be aware of guys in terms of their confidence and you know, where they might be struggling with their identity and usually with how their identity is being affected by other people's perceptions of it. My job in that is, and all our jobs, it's not just me, it's the rest of the support staff, it's the rest of the players, is to keep an eye out for that. You know, are people being affected by that? Do they need support and do they need particular advice? You know, we have a number of mechanisms in the club here that we would use to keep an eye out for just that kind of thing. And you know, that could be a conversation between myself and Jacob, but it could equally be a conversation between Hendy and Jacob.
Right. Okay. And do you like, so say there's 40 plus players, do you get, you can't get one-on-one time with each of them, I presume, across a given week. How do you manage all that?
That is corridor conversations. So I will have a certain amount of sit-down time with individuals, dependent on what their situation is and what's going on. You know, often those kind of conversations could be around selection. They could be around long-term prospects. It could be around all sorts of stuff. It could be around personal stuff that's going on the outside. But the vast majority of conversations are corridor conversations where, you know, you're making yourself available as much as you can by walking around the facility, checking out what you're doing, hanging around a little bit after training, being there during warm-ups. You know, when do you get a chance to say hello to somebody and see how they're getting on? And you know, if they've got something to say to you, oh, Dan, I just wanted to catch up on whatever. Or, you know, me spotting somebody who I might not have spoken to in the last couple of days and properly, you know, made a comment about their training or picked them up on something that they've done really well and the previous weekend. And I think that's those kind of more informal connections are at least as powerful and certainly more important than sitting down with somebody for 20 minutes in an office. The moment that you ask, this is one thing you learn as a head coach, the one thing that happens as soon as you say, do you want to pop up to the office and have a chat? They immediately assume that they're being dropped or they've done something wrong. Which is not helpful if you just want to chat. So that's sort of how I manage that, Joe.
Yeah, and is your relationship different with players now as a head coach? Do you have to be that bit more distant than you could afford to be as the assistant coach?
I don't think it's a question of distance. I think it's just a question of the nature of the relationship. You know, it is not possible to alter the fact that there is a power imbalance in that relationship, and I have to be really cognizant of that. So, as head coach, you know, I'm ultimately responsible for getting them for selecting the team. I'm also ultimately responsible for contracting or not contracting. So it doesn't really matter, you know, whatever that sits there. In terms of an assistant coach, it is different. You know, the assistant coach has a certain amount of responsibility and impact into selection and contracting, but it's not the same as the head coach. And also, they're dealing on a different basis there with the detail that they would go into on a day-to-day. So their relationships are really built around a lot of the detail that they're coaching and the specifics of what they're doing. So Roddy's relationship with Gareth Milicinovic, you know, there's a lot of it around his mauling. Their conversations are revolved around their line-out. And some of mine would be involved in that with Gareth, but there's also a much bigger picture that goes there in that relationship with Gareth and making sure that there is accessibility, even though there is that power imbalance, is critical and not always easy. And you know, some people naturally do that really well, and other people have to work at it.
Yeah, I was reading. I didn't realize you have a degree in the classics. I think Latin and Greek potentially from your younger days, and then interested in psychology, and you ended up doing a psychology degree. Does that come in useful in a practical day-to-day way being head coach of a rugby team? Do you find yourself harking back to semester three of your second year in college kind of thing?
not in the classics degree, although I do know where to look if I want to go and find something out about the Spartans. If you're a rugby coach at all, then having a good look at the Spartans and the movie 300, all the players love that. So that's worth following, but not really the psychology. Definitely every single day, and it gives you access into exploring different avenues, particularly around learning and particularly around leadership. So I'd be fascinated in both those topics. I originally started off on the path of wanting to be a teacher, and I was sort of halfway qualified as being a teacher and worked as a special needs assistant before I started being a professional rugby player. So the educationalist side of things is a huge love for me, and would have spent a lot of time over lockdown and when I was assistant coach for Scotland going into that side of the psychology, and the leadership stuff now is critical. If I'm not doing that, if I'm not learning on that, I'm actually not doing my job.
Are there fellow coaches who you can call up and brains you can pick? Can you call Joe Schmidt and say, can we talk about the breakdown? Is it that collegiate at your level?
It is. There's not much secret squirrel nowadays. Over lockdown, I would have spoken to Joe. Spoken to Andy Farrell. I would have spoken to Paul Gustard. I would have spoken to Steve Borthwick, Andy Friend, Johan Van Graan, Leo. All of these guys I would have had conversations with, just on the level of well, it could have been leadership, actually. It could have been rugby. It could have been COVID protocols. That's one of the interesting things as a head coach. If you're an assistant coach and you want to chat about leadership, you can chat with your head coach, or you can chat with operations director or the other guys around there. As a head coach, there is nobody in the organization that's experiencing the same things as you are, because there's only one of you. I have the ability and to be able to chat to Johnny Petrie around the wider organizational stuff and the structuring and contracting and with Bryn, obviously. But in terms of the actual head coaching job, there is nobody here who does the same job as me that I can chat to. So it's absolutely crucial that I have outlets outside the organization to help me with that.
That's great. So you can get on the phone and Leo and have a good old moan about referees in the media. I presume that's kind of the gist of it, yeah?
We have never moaned about the media, Joe, ever.
No, of course. Sure. So it has been, very noticeable as well over the last, I keep saying 2 years, but it's been a strange second year, that you've really given youth its chance. Was that a conscious philosophy? I'm going to trust you. That, if there's a young player, I'm throwing him in. Or in many respects, has it been your only option but to do that?
There's a bit of both. The natural attrition that goes on in rugby obviously requires us to use more than the 42 senior players that we have. So guys, unless you're ridiculously lucky, guys who are younger are going to get opportunities. But there is definitely a policy around that. What we're looking to develop in Ulster is around the growth of the club and the organisation. So sustainability over a longer period of time is really important. We're really lucky that there are a lot of guys, younger guys who are coming through who show talent. They work very hard and it's exciting to be able to get those guys onto the pitch. And we balance that with giving younger guys opportunities with the fact that we're in the business of winning matches. Nobody gets selected here for nothing. You have to earn your spot, and earning your spot might mean being ready when somebody else gets injured. But whatever happens, when you play, you've earned your spot.
You've got these games coming up now, and as I understand it, there are no warm-up games, there's no anything. It's straight in and business end of winning points and getting into knockout matches. So very interested to see how they'll go. I'm sure everybody is. One, because of the lack of warm-up games, so I don't know, can anybody be at full match fitness or match sharpness? And secondly, in a game like rugby, where it's physicality and it's adrenaline and the crowd are a part of that and a real part of that, and the atmosphere is a part of that, you know, it's hard to know what to expect. What are your thoughts on all that?
Yeah, well, I'll take the second point first on the crowd side of things. Like, you know, we're doing a fair bit of training inside the Kings fans stadium here, and we were actually just discussing that today. You know, what's it going to be like in Aviva with nobody there? I think the Irish Cup final the other day was littered with swearing over the referee's mic. Now, you know, they'll have to do something on a rugby field as well. So it's often not the cleanest vocabulary that's used out there. So that's going to be interesting, creating your own atmosphere and understanding that the job you've got to do remains the same, whether there's people in the stand or on the TV. In terms of preparing for games immediately at the start of the season, that is really interesting. There are no pre-season games here, and normally what would happen in pre-season games is that the first game that you go into, guys are playing, you know, they you might go in with a squad of 30 and normally guys play 40 minutes, they might play 60 minutes at most, but we're going straight into a game that's completely competitive where at least seven of them are going to play 80 minutes. So the preparation for that, we're in uncharted territory. Now, you know, we've got a lot of experts that we can tap into here, and you know they're doing a really good job. They've got a really good plan. But the bottom line is, it's pretty much uncharted territory. So it'll be an interesting one.
And I'm just presuming it's not possible to generate the same amount of adrenaline when there's not a crowd there.
Sugar, I don't know.
You can ask your SC guy later.
I think that I was just trying to think back to when I was playing, which is a long time ago. I there've been lots of games when I was playing that where you don't really notice the crowd for chunks of the match, but right, then when you really need them and they're getting behind you, you do notice them. So, yeah, I guess they would be. Like here at Kingspan, for instance, if we're playing in big European games and those tight moments come and stand up for the Ulsterman is roaring out over the pitch as you're running to a line out 5 meters from Racing's line, I have absolutely no doubt that when I think about it, that adds to the adrenaline of it. So the replacement of that with a silent crowd is going to all have to be about what we're trying to achieve and what we need to do.
Yeah. So Connacht are on the horizon. Obviously, you're no stranger to Connacht. It's funny, you talked a moment ago about how maybe you were going to go into teaching and then rugby comes into your life and suddenly you spend, 6 years playing at Connacht, another 9 years coaching there and across Ireland. It's funny how life goes. What did you take from that whole experience? It's a considerable part of your life spent in Galway.
Yeah. I loved it in Galway. My son Thomas was born there, and my daughter Alex and Thomas grew up there and did the vast chunk of their schooling there. And we got a lot of really good friends who are still there. And it was interesting because when I arrived, as a player the previous year, I was at Stade Francais, and you know, although I didn't play as many games as I would have liked, we'd won the French Championship that year. And when I arrived in Connacht, I think we had 11 full-time professionals in the squad, and you know, full-time professionals was a loose description of what we were at the time. But geez, there was so much passion and so much heart, and you know, the coach who was there then, he arrived the same time as me, Stefanel, a South African guy, and Steph was old school, but it was exactly what we needed. It was exactly, it was time and place, like the context was perfect. He whipped us into shape and put us into a pretty good position to naturally move on to the Michael Bradley era, and Michael Bradley moved us on as well. I reckon that the biggest thing I learned, Joe, in Connacht was that it doesn't matter what happens at the weekend, you have to be able to enjoy your job on a Monday morning. Finding how to do that is a huge part of your own sustainability in professional rugby. And I would say that's important whether you're playing at Leinster or you're playing at the Kings. You still have to, because professional rugby, even if you're at a one of the winningest clubs like Leinster, it still has huge up and downs. So you can't measure your life's enjoyment on whether you've actually won at the weekend or not. It's got to be something more than that. Your purpose and your drive every week has got to be something more than that.
And so how do you do that on a Monday morning?
It's development. It's learning. Absolutely 100%. Because whether you've won in a historic victory or whether you've lost and you've played terribly, there's always something to get better at on Monday. So if you turn up, and you can't stop, it's not that you're going to be miserable, not be miserable if you play terrible, but you can come in on a Monday morning with that feeling of, yeah, I've taken a massive kick in the groin here. I'm really down about it, but I'm telling you, when I go home at the end on Monday, I'm going to have achieved something. And even if you're 5% better at the end of that Monday, you can sit down and say, "Well, yeah, I've actually done it today. I've actually got better, so I'm more likely not to suffer that again the next time." Because let's face it, we all suffer setbacks, don't we?
Yeah. Well, listen, no kidding. Just a last point. I saw it with all the youth coming through and all those young players coming through. You bought in Albie Mathieson, who Munster fans were very sad to see go, and Ian Madigan has returned as well. Is Ian Madigan coming in, Dan, as very much a 10, and that's what he wants to do now for the remainder of his career, or will he be moving around that back line a bit?
Look, Ian's a 10. We signed Ian as a 10. Ian's obviously a very talented player and has a certain amount of versatility, but he's definitely here as a 10 to give us a little bit of experience. In the same way as Albie's here as a 9 and to add experience to our halfback stocks.
Very good. And lastly, I was just reading a quirk of circumstance. Your grandfather's from Belfast.
That's correct. Yeah. He is. He grew up here and left to go and study in the UK as an engineer. He played a bit of rugby over here. He was a Gaelic footballer as well. But he died when I was 10. But I loved him. He left me with a love for Irish rugby. Him and my dad. Watching grandstand and Ireland playing back in the 80s on a Saturday during the Six Nations, Five Nations was my upbringing in rugby.
Okay, and so who were you made support?
What, country wise?
Yeah,
Ireland always.
No question. No turning around saying I'm
not. No, never.
Never.
No, Joe, it's an issue that I've always had on a rugby identity point of view. I've got an accent that sounds like I should be reading the news on the BBC, mate. But I've always been an Ireland supporter.
Right. Okay. God. And I guess the kids would be the same then if they're Galway.
Yeah, my son's blood runs green, mate. So.
Okay.
He has Ireland flags everywhere.
Right. And did your dad play rugby?
Yes, yeah. My dad was actually really good player. He played for London Irish, right. Headingley. He was a centre winger, goal kicker.
How did he end up with the prop, son?
Yeah, fed me too much. I like to tell people when I was at school, I scored a try in the Ross and Park School sevens from 80 metres out. Nobody ever believes me, and of course there was no video back then, so I can get away with that, but it's actually true.
Oh, well, listen, I don't doubt it. Very good. I hadn't realized all that. Listen, we're tight for time, and you've been more than good, and we sort of had to do this twice at the start as well, courtesy of Wi-Fi issues. So thanks so much for the time, and the very best of luck come August. And then, listen, we might try and grab a word sometime around a European Cup quarterfinal if you're free. But in the meantime, Dan McFarlane, thanks so much.
No problems, Joe. My pleasure. Thanks very much.
The OTB Podcast Network with Virgin Media. Catch all of the UEFA Champions League and Europa League games live on Virgin Media TV.